Welcome to Irregular Climate, where we take a look at the irregular climate in our atmosphere and the irrational climate of global warming denialism. On this week's show, an assessment of the assessment, the exoneration of man, the final nail in the climate gate coffin, bad reporting, dishonesty and hate, and the skeptic debunk of the week. I am Dan Mutal. First, a quick note as to why it is just me this week. I am sad to report that Graham Wayne is no longer able to co-host the podcast with me. I owe Graham a great deal. He has been instrumental in improving the quality of Irregular Climate. He will be missed. Thankfully, he has allowed me to continue to use the music he composed as the theme for the podcast. Thanks for everything, Graham. For now, I will be flying solo, except for the skeptic debunk of the week provided by John Cook. However, if you are interested in producing a segment, this could be a one-off piece or a longer series, please drop me a line. This week, we have several stories that further boast our trust in mainstream climatology. Up first is an assessment of the assessment. The Netherlands Environmental Assessment Agency has just released a report of their investigation into the scientific foundations for the IPCC Summary Assessment Report. And they found that the summary conclusions of the IPCC report can be considered well-founded, and none have been found to contain any significant errors. This assessment of the IPCC was requested by the Dutch Minister for the Environment after it was revealed that a sentence in the IPCC about the amount of land in the Netherlands that was below sea level, a sentence which came from the Dutch government, was possibly incorrect depending on the exact definition of sea level. As the IPCC notes, there are several definitions of the area below sea level. For example, the Dutch Ministry of Transport uses the amount below high water level during storms, which is roughly 60%, while other ministries use the area under mean sea level, which is roughly 30%. Needless to say, the actual number mentioned in the report has no real bearing on any IPCC conclusions and has nothing to do with climate science. It is questionable whether this should even be counted as a real IPCC error, especially given the source, which was the Dutch government itself. And the Dutch assessment agreed with this, finding that the IPCC conclusions were well-founded and none contained any significant errors. So all in all, a boring story that changes absolutely nothing. So some irresponsible members of the media decided to spice things up a little, focusing exclusively on some of the constructive criticism found within the Dutch assessment. This criticism is welcome because while the IPCC's reports are incredibly useful and are broadly accurate, actually they're much more than broadly accurate, they're incredibly accurate, they are not perfect. The IPCC procedures are not perfect, and constructive criticism can help improve them. But irresponsible members of the media focused entirely on these constructive criticisms and painted a picture that was decidedly different from the conclusions found in the Dutch assessment. And speaking of vindication, Michael Mann has been fully exonerated by the investigation at Penn State University. After the ClimateGate emails were revealed, several allegations were made against Michael Mann, including: did Mann do anything to suppress or falsify data? Did Mann delete information or data? Did Mann misuse privileged or confidential information? And did Mann do anything that seriously deviated from accepted practice within the academic community for proposing, conducting, or reporting research or other scholarly activities? The first investigation into Michael Mann cleared him on the first three of those allegations. And while they didn't find any evidence against him for the fourth allegation, they felt they weren't adequately suited to rule on the matter, so they referred judgment until that charge could be properly investigated. And now it has been. And this is what the investigators concluded. The investigatory committee, after a careful review of all available evidence, determined that there is no substance to the allegation against Michael Mann. The decision of the investigatory committee was unanimous. In other words, a full exoneration. There simply is no evidence that Mann has acted inappropriately. Of course, the Nyers are claiming this is some sort of whitewash. It's all part of this massive conspiracy. What they don't bother asking or thinking about is why would a world-class institution like Penn State risk its reputation for a single investigator, like Mann? The best they do is claim that they're doing it in order to preserve the grant money that someone like Mann brings in. But the numbers really don't back up this claim. So from about 2006 to 2009, Mann's grants totaled of $1.8 million. Now that sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money. But in that same period, Penn State's total research income was $2.8 billion, or $2,800 million. Mann's grants represented much less than 1% of the total research money that Penn State was granted between 2006 and 2009. Michael Mann just isn't that important to Penn State, and they have no reason to exonerate him if he has broken academic contact, if he has acted inappropriately. Of course, those simple facts have no bearing on what deniers are willing to say. Michael Mann has been attacked probably more than anyone else. And for those of you who are not sure who he is the author of the original hockey stick graph. We've talked about it before on this podcast. But he has been attacked more than anyone else by deniers. And the facts just don't back up their claims. He has been vindicated by he's been exonerated by Penn State. They found no evidence to support the claims against him. But this has no bearing on what the denialists will say or do. They will continue to beat this drum, regardless of what the facts say. To deniers, any investigation that does not conform to their preconceived notion is only evidence of a massive conspiracy. That's why we call them deniers. And if that wasn't enough, the Mueller-Russell report was released this week. This was a 6-month-long investigation into the email stolen from the server of the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia in the UK. This is sometimes referred to as ClimateGate. This investigation tracked down every allegation made against Crewe and systematically demolished them, concluding that on the specific allegations made against the behavior of Crewe scientists, we find their rigor and honesty as scientists are not in doubt. In addition, we do not find that their behavior has prejudiced the balance of advice given to policymakers. In particular, we do not find any evidence of behavior that might undermine the conclusions of the IPCC assessments. There you have it. Pretty big exoneration. Now, this really shouldn't be surprising because it's the same basic conclusion reached by two other independent investigations into the stolen emails. So that's three investigations in the UK all coming to the same conclusion, giving us replication, which bolsters our confidence in the results. And that, if that's not enough, we have, as discussed earlier, the investigations by Penn State into Michael Mann's conduct, which touch on many of the ClimateGate issues. They all point to the same conclusion, that scientists acted appropriately. And if that isn't enough, we recently had a set of three reports published by the National Academies of Science in the United States that, while didn't touch on the issues of ClimateGate directly, did strongly reaffirm the conclusions that our greenhouse gas emissions are causing the warming trend in the planet. Now, the Mueller-Russell report does mention that the scientists should have been more opened, but as has been mentioned elsewhere, it is frequently the government's own policies, such as privatization and the desire to profit from the data collected by some government agencies that impede some of the data from being released. As the Oxborough report concluded, and this was one of the previous two investigations, they concluded, we observe that there were important unresolved questions that relate to the availability of environmental data set. It was pointed out that since the UK government adapted a policy that resulted in charging for access to data sets collected by government agencies, other countries have followed suit, impeding the flow of processed and raw data to and between researchers. This is unfortunate and seems inconsistent with the policies of open access to data promoted elsewhere in government. Now, certainly this has been the case here in Canada, where some of the data that the scientists at CREW were unable to release was from Environment Canada, and Environment Canada did not allow its release. The data is frequently sold to those who want it. However, working scientists in the field tend to get it for free. Perhaps the government should investigate themselves if they claim to want openness. But the Muir-Russell report makes it clear that CREW acted appropriately in not releasing the data it had no authority to release. Shocking, isn't it? And in what has to be a blow to McIntyre and his merry band of auditors, or rather, what should be a blow if they had any relationship to reality, the Muir-Russell report states, to carry out the analysis, we obtained raw primary instrumental temperature station data. This can be obtained either directly from the appropriate National Meteorological Office or by consulting the World Weather Records. Anyone working in this area would have knowledge of the availability of data from these sources. Any independent researcher may freely obtain the primary data. It is impossible for a third party to withhold access to the data. And in regards to the code that wasn't public, the report says, the computer code required to read and analyze the instrumental temperature data is straightforward to write based upon the published literature. It amounts to a few hundred lines of executable code. Such code could be written by any research unit which is competent to reproduce or test the CREW-TEM analysis. For the trial analysis of the review team, the code is written in less than 2 days and produced similar results to other independent analysis. No information from CREW was required to do this. Clearly, the self-proclaimed auditors could have rolled up their sleeves and reproduced all the work done by CREW and others. But clearly, this wasn't their intent. Their intent was to complain, moan, and whine, to sow doubt, uncertainty, and doubt where none exists. The deniers' response to all of this is entirely predictable. They're calling this a whitewash. Now, their claims wouldn't seem so hollow if they weren't cheerleading the mere existence of these investigations as guilty until proven innocent when they were first announced. Now it's all part of a giant conspiracy. So what do? Well, the Global Warming Policy Foundation, a think tank whose stated goal is to oppose climate mitigation policy, has announced that it will conduct its own investigation. Because who better to lead an impartial, dispassionate investigation than a think tank whose stated goal is anything but impartial and dispassionate? Pathetic. Now, despite the absurd criticisms from deniers, there are more reasonable problems and criticisms of the Muir-Russell report. For example, it never really acknowledges the problems that a small research unit, typically less than 5 full-time employees, would have in finding the resources and funding to be an early adopter in open data and public communications, as the report suggests. Never mind responding to a flood of freedom information requests. According to the rules, you have to do 18 hours of work on each freedom of information request before you're allowed to turn it down. How on earth were the scientists at CREW supposed to respond to a flood of freedom information requests, which at their peak were over 60 a month and at times over 40 in just a few days? There just aren't enough hours in the day, never mind doing the science that they're paid to do. Given all of that, though, it isn't surprising that the freedom of information requests were not done. The scientists at CREW were asked to do the impossible. The report never looked into the organized campaign by self-proclaimed auditors to spam these requests. This is understandable since the organized denial campaign was outside the scope of the report, but there is no mention of the asymmetry of standards. If deniers were to be held to the same standards that the crew scientists are held, they would be demolished. Their claims would be completely and utterly torn apart and shown to be completely baseless and completely dishonest. This behavior is something that should be looked at by a similar investigation, but I'm not going to hold my breath. But all of this is really getting to the nitty-gritty. The bottom line is that the report confirmed what we already knew, that the scientists at CREW were honest individuals and that their behavior did not affect the advice given to policymakers or the conclusions of the IPCC assessments. That is the bottom line, and that is what needs to be emphasized. So that's three separate investigations this week alone, and several more that happened earlier, that all paint a consistent and unsurprising picture. That mainstream climate science is trustworthy, and its conclusions are, as far as anyone can tell, correct. Nothing surprising, but the forces of denialism are still strong. One of the reasons for this is an incompetent media. Take, for example, the article "Climategate Jibes Fly Over El Nino Impact on Warming," written by Fred Pierce and published by New Scientist, which usually does a decent job of science journalism. This article is about a study published last year in the Journal of Geophysical Research, which claimed that a natural climate forcing associated with El Niño Southern Oscillation is a major contributor to the variability and perhaps recent trends in global temperature, a relationship that is not included in current global climate models. One of the study authors, Bob Carter, took this a step further by saying the close relationship between El Niño Southern Oscillation and global temperatures, as described in the paper, leaves little room for any warming driven by human carbon dioxide emissions. There was just one problem with this study. The methods used by the authors completely removed any long-term trend from the data, which makes it impossible to say anything about those long-term trends. In other words, this study said absolutely nothing about climate change. This was immediately apparent to a bunch of scientists who wrote a response to the paper, which was published by the journal that originally publicized the flawed study. So how is this presented by Fred Pierce? As a typical he said, she said story. There is zero attempt to assess the validity of either side. This is unacceptable, especially when, as is the case here, one side has no validity. The references to ClimateGate was particularly inappropriate, given that several independent investigations found nothing nefarious. It is this type of fair and balanced reporting that is largely responsible for the mess we find ourselves in. Reporters need to do more than just present all sides of the story. They need to assess the validity of those sides, which means they need to do some actual reporting. They need to understand the issue. It's hard work, but that is what a good journalist is required to do. No one said journalism had to be easy. This article should be held up as a model for how reporting should not be done. The way in which the media is covering the string of recent vindications of mainstream climate science is nothing but dishonest, and it fails to repair the damage created by the media's rush to judgment a mere 6 months ago. We all deserve better. But it gets much worse than that. My comment about the paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that analyzed the expertise and prominence of scientists who have signed public declarations stating that they are convinced or unconvinced by the evidence for global warming, and the disgusting references to the Stasi and Holocaust made by some deniers got a lot more attention than I expected. Why? Because Mark Morano linked to my post and posted my email address on his site, Climate Depot. What happened after provided me a look at why Moreno should not be trusted and the absolute hate that his followers have for people like me who accept mainstream science and are disgusted by inappropriate equivalents to the horrible events in recent history that cheapen the experiences of those who survived them. So, what happened? Moreno misread my post and assumed that I didn't know that the Stasi were not Nazis. So Moreno did a quick write-up and took different parts of my post and mashed them together to make it seem like I thought the Stasis were Nazis. For the record, I spent exactly 0 seconds thinking that the Stasi were part of the Nazi movement. I was complaining about both the references to the Stasi and the Nazis. They're both disgusting. The Nazi references, however, I take personally. And if that wasn't enough, Moreno also published my email address. So I mentioned this to Moreno, and he responded saying that he himself did not make a Nazi reference. When I was collecting links to this story, I was fairly certain that I followed a link from Moreno to a site that was making Nazi references. However, since I couldn't come up with this link when Moreno mentioned this to me, I quickly issued a correction on my post. But I made it clear that he did make a reference to the Stasi. Now, Moreno eventually accepted that he was wrong about me thinking the Stasis were Nazis, and he said he would post a correction. So did he? Not really, but he did take my email address down. Instead, he published this, updated, "Oops, alarmist attempts to slam Climate Depot for Nazi reference, but Climate Depot did not make one. Only to East German Stasi." So instead of issuing a correction, he focused on my admittedly real error, but an error that I had already corrected. Nowhere did he retract his original incorrect claim. It still exists. The only thing he changed was him adding a link to his clarification. But to make matters even worse, that link is broken. Not very honest, if you ask me. Now, none of this really matters that much, but it serves to highlight how even on issues that are ultimately inconsequential, Moreno cannot be trusted. On matters of real substance, Moreno is completely untrustworthy, frequently bending the truth beyond all recognition. But there is another aspect of this issue that deserves attention, and it is far more important and frightening. It has been reported elsewhere that climate scientists have seen an increase of threatening emails since the crew email leak late last year. One major reason for this is the fact that Mark Moreno publishes the email addresses of anyone he is attacking. He published my email address, and even though it was only on his site for a short time, it got me plenty of hate mail. Now, most were just baseless assaults on my character, but a significant number of them wished me harm, usually in the form of a painful death, or something along those lines. But some of them were threats of violence towards me. There were hundreds of emails, and my address was only posted for a few hours. It wasn't pretty, but it didn't make me worry about my safety. However, were I in the same position of Michael Mann or Steven Schneider or any other top climatologist that is frequently in the crosshairs of Moreno, I'm not sure I could say that. Their email addresses are frequently published, and unlike a relative unknown like myself, deniers are well aware of who these people are. They are frequently mentioned by Moreno, and to make matters worse, their place of work is public knowledge. This level of vitriol and hate that Moreno directs with his site is astonishing, and he knows it. That he continues to publish email addresses is irresponsible, to say the least. Up next, we have John Cook and the Skeptic Debunk of the Week.
Carbon dioxide causes warming. Generally speaking, as CO2 levels go up, so too does global temperature. But there's a period in the mid-20th century when global temperature actually cooled, even though CO2 levels were still rising. Why didn't it warm? The answer is that CO2 is not the only driver of climate. A variety of forces influence global temperature. One of these is another product of human pollution, sulfate aerosols. These are small particles or droplets that hang suspended in the atmosphere. When aerosols get up into the stratosphere, they reflect sunlight back into space, so less sunlight reaches the Earth's surface. This is called global dimming. From the 1950s to the 1980s, there was global dimming and daytime temperatures went down. However, nighttime temperatures continued to warm. This is because night is more affected by the greenhouse effect than the amount of sunlight. So even during mid-century cooling, the warming from CO2 emissions was percolating away while we were sleeping. In the mid-1980s, the amount of sulfate aerosols in the atmosphere started to fall. The global dimming that was masking greenhouse warming was removed, and the warming trend reasserted itself.
That's it for this week's show. Show notes will be posted at irregularclimate.com. And yes, I know that last week's show notes have yet to be posted. The extra workload involved with producing the show myself, Graham used to do the editing and he was good at it. I'm still just learning the ropes, has forced me to delay putting the show notes together. Hopefully, I can catch up soon. Also, at our website, irregularclimate.com, we have plenty of RSS feeds for subscribing to the podcast. We are also available in the iTunes Music Store and the Zune Marketplace. So why not write a review or rate us? We also have links at our site to our Twitter and Facebook pages. Follow us and send us feedback. Tell us what we are doing well and what we need to work harder on. Also, if you feel so inclined and want to support the podcast, you can download to Irregular Climate via PayPal. The links are all on the website. But if you are unable or unwilling to donate, please continue to download and listen. That in and of itself supports the show and helps it grow. I am Dan Mutal. You can follow me online at ofdan.ca, where you can see links to my blog, my personal Twitter feed, my Flickr feed, and everything else I do online. Thanks, and until next week, try and stay regular.